My name is Tom Torrey, and I'm here with former Wing Commander Stanley Mansbridge. The date is May 15th, and we're in Victoria. All right, sir, could we begin with when and where you were born?
Yes, I was born in May 1918 in Folkestone, Kent. Actually in a Canadian military hospital.
So your father was in the service at this time?
Yes, he was serving with the Canadian Army, having joined up in the fall of 1914, like so many young Canadians of that time. Trained initially in Toronto, then at Camp Valcartier in Quebec, and then early in 1915 over to England to prepare to join and form a brigade, Canadian brigade for the Western Front.
And so you were technically a Canadian citizen?
Yes, as I learned when I came back to Canada in 1954, by right of birth.
Okay. Now, when did you yourself get into the military? It was the reserves, wasn't it?
Yes, I, again, like so many of my contemporaries, in the late 30s, was fully aware that war seemed inevitable. And I first tried to join the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve for flying training, but was unable to get the necessary consent from my father, who, as a result of his experiences in the 1418 war, was bitterly opposed to war under any circumstances. Nevertheless, when I was 21 in May 1939, I was eligible and did become a member of the Royal Air Force Volunteer Reserve, and from that point on I waited to be called for training.
What was the training like in the reserves, or was there any training?
Well, because war was so imminent, there was no training. Everything was suspended for preparation for the war. And actually, I wasn't called up for training until the late spring of 1940, by which time the Germans were beginning to roll all over Western Europe. The first piece of training was what was called an initial training wing in Devon in England, which was essentially to be equipped with a uniform, to learn some simple drill or military discipline, I suppose. We were distinguished from ordinary airmen as airmen waiting aircrew training by wearing little white flecks in our forage caps. And of course you can imagine we wore those with a great deal of pride. From there we expected to go to elementary flying training school. But the war situation had deteriorated so badly that we were sent off for ground defense duties.
What was that like? What were your duties?
Well, there were just a very small number of us were posted to an Air Force base near Edinburgh called DREM, D-R-E-M. It's almost ludicrous to think back, but of course the invasion scare was at its height. We were required to patrol 1.5 miles each of coastline, equipped with one rifle and 5 rounds of ammunition. You would march from a contact point, 1.5 miles, to the next contact point, say hello to your buddy, then turn around and march 1.5 miles back. I shudder to think what would have happened to the German army if they tried to evade that piece of coastline.
How long did this period last for?
Oh, about 3 or 4 months we were at DREM. And then we were a small group of us, I think there were about 10 altogether at that time. Were posted to another RAF wartime base at Prestwick, now the famous Prestwick International Airport, but then a very small civil airport. There we were to do the first leg of training as pilots. But within a few days of arriving there, we were informed that the flying training school had been discontinued. This was very largely because of the great expansion that had taken place in the Commonwealth Air Training Plan, which provided for most of the initial training of pilots in Canada and also in Rhodesia. So having been told that this training program had been suspended in Prestwick, we were then obviously waiting for our next posting, and presumably we would go to Canada. But then we were convened a few days later and told that there was a desperate shortage of trained air observers for Bomber Command of the Royal Air Force, and the Air Ministry were asking our group and others if we would volunteer for training as air observers, which incidentally is a term used in those days for a combination of a navigator, bomb aimer, and air gunner. So we were asked if we would train as a matter of patriotic duty. And we were given 24 hours in which to make up our minds. Most of us did in fact decide that we couldn't face the prospect of the war ending before we got into it, and therefore we better take the training as air observers, which incidentally was to be carried out at Prestwick itself.
And as it turns out, it was a good decision considering the fate of one of the people in your group who decided not to do the air observers training.
Yes, I think two of them decided they were going to hang in there and wait for pilot training. Well, you'll remember this was the spring of 1941. In the summer of 1943, after I had completed my second bomber tour, one of those two ex-friends turned up as a new fully trained pilot to begin his first tour of operation, and he'd had all the best part of 3 years of waiting, initial training, advanced flying training, waiting, finally getting returned to Britain, waiting again for an operational training unit, and then waiting again for vacancy on a squadron. I suppose it was, there was one comfort. The casualties had not been, up until at least the summer of 1943, as heavy as had first been forecast. So that there was a surplus of air crew building up in the pipeline. Nevertheless, it was somewhat ironic that that he'd had to wait almost 3 years to get into the war, which for me, as air crew, was coming at that point almost to a completion.
What was your rank at this period?
Well, we were, throughout our training, we were leading, it's a rank of leading aircraftman, as I say, with this distinguishing mark as aircrew under training. And we remained in that rank until the training, basic training, was finished. That's the training in navigation at Prestwick, in bombing and air gunnery at Manby, RAF Station Manby in Lincolnshire. The next step was to be posting to an operational training unit, and you can visualize how from various training patterns came pilots, air observers, wireless operators, and air gunners coming to form crews for posting to operational squadrons. At the end of my formal training period, it's navigation, air gunnery, and air bombing, I was notified that I had been commissioned and was given 10 days to turn myself into an officer before reporting to an operational training unit up at Hayford, just north of Oxford. And I say turn myself into an officer, that meant finding a tailor, getting uniform made.
Did you have to provide your own uniform, pay for it?
No, that was covered by a grant. And it's a little diversion, but I want to tell you something that happened to me when I arrived at the operational training unit of Upper Hayford. The first person, and you'll appreciate, here was I, a newly commissioned pilot officer, dignified by a rank stripe on my arm so thin that it could have cut a slice of bread. You are required, when you report as an officer to an Air Force station, to report to the station adjutant, which I did. I was rather surprised. It must have been about 10:30 in the morning when I arrived, and the station seemed to be in a state of extreme quiet. There were no sign of aircraft, there were very few people about. Nevertheless, I arrived in the adjutant's office, introduced myself, was given the inevitable form to fill up, an arrival certificate. And whilst I was doing that, the telephone rang, and the adjutant, who was a First World War pilot, wearing the ribbons of that World War, he was was answering the telephone. And he was obviously very annoyed, and he kept saying, "It's impossible, you know that we have a stand down today, everyone has more or less got the day off, no, you couldn't have picked the worst possible time." And then he paused, and I was conscious that he was looking at me, and he said, "Well, you're lucky, I've got someone." And he put down the phone, and he looked over my arrival certificate, and then said, "Look, I have a duty for you to perform this afternoon. It's not pleasant, but it's necessary, and it's one of the duties that officers have to perform from time to time." He said, there was an aircraft crash, two nights ago, the whole crew were killed. And it's the funeral this afternoon of the pilot and the only officer in that crew, and he and we need an extra pallbearer, officer pallbearer, for the funeral. You have that duty to perform. Will you report to the station warrant officer at 2 o'clock? And I couldn't help but think, well, that's a wonderful introduction to an operational training unit to attend a funeral. But the story wasn't quite over yet. I next reported to the officer's mess to get my quarters and was introduced to my batman. Incidentally, a batman is a sort of a general help, and he was normally a batman assigned four officers to look after. So he took me with luggage over to the building in which my quarters were and went upstairs to my room. And then as he opened the door, I saw the luggage just inside the door. And he said, oh, Batman said, oh, hell, I was supposed to have taken that out this morning. He took it out of the room, and of course then I noticed on the side of the luggage printed the name of its owner, pilot officer, and then realized that this was the person whose funeral I was to participate in that afternoon. And I couldn't stop saying this to the batman. He was a little fellow, a little cockney Londoner. And he said, well, sir, I have to tell you, this is a very unlucky room. He said, we've had three dead ones in this room. And he said, he must have seen the look on my face. So he said, but you shouldn't worry, sir. As you know, things always go in threes. This will be the turning point. Yes? Yeah, we'll have some coffee in a few minutes.
Okay.
All right. Well, that, quite frankly, is one of the most vivid memories I have of the operational training unit, although, of course, it was the occasion when, as I said, we were formed a crew. My pilot-to-be was a South African who had volunteered, had pre-war flying experience, had volunteered as soon as the war started. And we had a successful 2 months of flying together as a crew and learning as much as we possibly could of both, particularly of night flying, night navigation. And then we were, at the end of that 2 months, we were posted to number 49 squadron of number 5 bomber group of Bomber Command, and 49 Squadron was based at Scampton, RAF Station Scampton, just north of Lincoln. And of course, the Bomber Command was concentrated on the eastern counties of England, counties like Yorkshire, Lincolnshire, and Norfolk particularly. There was a practice in Bomber Command, particularly in those days, of sending new crews on what were considered to be easy first operations as an introduction to the war. And we had to wait something like 10 days before we were given our first operational assignment. And it was to attack shipping, German shipping in the harbor at Cherbourg in northern France. Shall I carry on?
And it wasn't the easy run you expected.
Remember, these were supposed to be easy. In our run-up to the target, it was a beautiful night to begin with. It was there was moon. There was cloudless. You could see great distances in the moonlight. We could see the harbor at Cherbourg from several miles out to sea, and we made our approach in the recommended direction. And as we closed in on the target area, searchlights switched on and caught us. And it's very difficult to get out of a cone of searchlights, because once you start the heavy evasive action, the compass becomes useless. You know, in those days they were spirit compasses, so once you started shaking the aircraft around, the compass lost its immediate validity. Searchlights are blinding so that you can't see, and it was quite a while, it seemed, before we got out of that cone. And whilst we were in the cone, there was gunfire from the ground, nothing particularly close. Nevertheless, you could see the puffs of smoke of the exploding shells. And the next thing we saw, at least our rear gunner saw, was a Messerschmitt 109 fighter closing in on our tail. And the pilot did the only thing possible under the circumstances, you know, gambling that he would get out of the lights before we hit the ocean. He dived as low as possible. And we did. We got out of the lights and were able to pull out about 300 or 400 feet above the sea. The snare was, though, that we hadn't dropped our bombs. So we went out to sea a bit, and we got back up to 10,000-12,000 feet, and with, I'm sure, as much fear in our hearts as there is room for, we ran into the target again without any difficulty at all, and dropped our bombs. I don't know whether they did much damage. And then we returned to base in Lincolnshire, having carried out our easy operation.
All right, perhaps now you could tell us what a typical day in the life at Scampton would be like when you weren't flying a mission, all the activities they had and general conditions.
Mm-hmm. Now, operational flying, of course, was determined by the weather.
Yes.
And clearly there's a variation in the time of the year, but I did most of my first 12 operations through the fall and winter of 1941-42, and flying conditions, of course, are very poor in the winter, and you were lucky if you could get in more than one operation per 7 to 10 days. So there was a lot of time just playing around. And nevertheless, there was often the assumption that there would be flying that night, weather permitting, so that you had to prepare for it. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about that kind of day first. Now remember that virtually all of our operational flying was night.
Yes.
Night bombing. Therefore, there was no question of an early start in the morning. We would do what was called a night flying test, which would simply be a 30-minute flight to test the aircraft and its various bits and pieces. You know, the wireless operator will clearly want to test his equipment. The gunner would want to test his guns in his turret. The pilot obviously had a complete flying drill for testing. The navigator would want to test his navigation equipment. He had, incidentally, a radio receiver in order to get bearings from fixed radio beacons, which were a very important navigation aid in those days. He'd also want to test the bomb sight and the bomb controls, the fuse controls, and so on, and also check his gun in the front of our operational aircraft at Scampton, which was a Hamden. Now, the Hamden was a twin-engined medium bomber of a most peculiar shape and disposition. Nevertheless, if you survived in it, you liked it. And no matter who you talked to in Bomber Command, they all believed they flew in the best aircraft. The Hamden was certainly an unusual aircraft. So you'd have a night flying test to test the equipment. Later on in the day, assuming that the operation was still on for the night, there'd be a briefing session. Normally some 2 to 3 hours before takeoff time. And the object of briefing clearly was for the meteorological officer to talk about the weather conditions, the intelligence officer to talk about the reason for the for the selection of the target and the enemy strength in the target area in terms of searchlights, anti-aircraft, fighter units. The squadron commander would invariably give a pep talk, usually very brief and greeted mostly with derision. And that would end briefing. The navigator would be the busy person immediately following the briefing because he'd have to plot courses in terms of forecast weather conditions, particularly wind velocities. And then sergeants off to their mess, officers off to their mess for a meal before takeoff. And that, of course, was always the worst period. Obviously, you weren't going to drink, and you'd sit around in the mess waiting for takeoff time. And then in those days, particularly, as I intimated just now, more often than not, the operation would be cancelled.
At the last minute?
Often at the last minute. Well, no, that's making it too dramatic. Really, at the last minute, literally, only once, for example, have I ever been in an aircraft approaching the circuit of the airfield, then to have an operation cancelled. That only happened once. Normally it would be anywhere from 1 to 3 hours before planned takeoff.
Was there a sense of relief or disgust or both?
Yeah. Oh yes, you were always. You know, there may have been. In fact, I think I knew one or two people that weren't scared of operational flying, but the vast majority were, of course. There was. It was a dangerous business. To have those possibilities postponed for 24 hours was always delightful. One other little diversionary story. We had a New Zealander who was quiet, as New Zealanders tend to be, extremely popular, again, as New Zealanders tended to be. Although an experienced pilot and a very good pilot, had never driven an automobile, never owned one. And we thought this was ludicrous. Now, when aircrew went missing, their next of kin were notified of their effects. And of course, a lot of them did have automobiles, usually near wrecks, ancient vehicles. And quite often, the next of kin would say that they would like that to be given to one of his friends. Yeah. And because there was an RAF benevolent fund, the normal practice was to sort of put a notice up in the officer's mess, say, so-and-so's car is available for any officer who wishes it. It'll be auctioned on such and such an hour on such and such a day, and the proceeds would go into the RAF Benevolent Fund, and you would see, you know, silly little sort of the equivalent of $5 bids and so on, and cars often went for a fraction of their value, of course. Well, this New Zealander, a syndicate decided to acquire him an automobile. And accordingly bought one, I think, for about £5. And that very day, we'd had one of these situations where right up almost to the last hour or so, we were due to fly, and then it was cancelled. And it was to be Essen. It was to be to Essen, which was one of the hardest targets to attack because it was right in the heart of the industrial belt of the Ruhr, and it was, you had to fly through all kinds of defenses to get there. And nobody liked Essen as a target, and this was cancelled. Well, the neighbouring squadron on the other side, we were north of Lincoln, and Swinderby was south and west of Lincoln. We're talking about, you know, 10 miles apart. The people at 50 Squadron at Swinderby called us and said, look, we're going to have an ad hoc party tonight to celebrate. Would you like to come over and join us? So we got together the necessary cars, including our New Zealand friends, and we made him drive because we thought, well, this is an opportunity for him to learn. Now, you want to realize we probably had a few beers before we left. And to get to from Scampton to Swindon, we had to go through the city of Lincoln. And Lincoln is one of these famous old Roman cities. In fact, right in the center of the High Street, there is an arch which was built by the Romans. And, of course, it was built before automobiles. And there's only room for one automobile at a time to go through the arch. And it's a sacred thing in Lincoln, and so on and so forth. Well, with great difficulty, we negotiated our way through it en route to Swinderby. It was coming back that the problems arose. And again, our New Zealand friend was forced to drive, but now with far greater confidence because he had consumed a reasonable amount of beer. And in trying to negotiate this famous arch, he hit it, and of course damaged it. And there are a few crimes in Britain that measure up to the crime of damaging the Roman arch in the heart of Lincoln. And by the time the policeman had finished jotting down all the offences the New Zealander had committed, after all, he didn't have a license, the car wasn't licensed, he had no insurance, he driving without care and attention, driving under the influence. It was obvious that if it ever came to court, he would be obviously executed for this. But anyhow, that's the... he put up a wonderful defense in court. We decided we completely misjudged him. Instead of being quiet, he was loquacious. It was the lady magistrates, typical of wartime in Britain, even the magistrates were our ladies. A lady magistrate with two assistants on the bench, both ladies. And when she finally asked our friend if he had anything to say, in a very persuasive, almost film starish voice, he said no, he had nothing to say, except that he thought your worship should know that the circumstances, and he explained how we'd been invited to this party after the cancellation of this very important operation, which obviously would take place on any one of these succeeding nights, we were invited to this party at and I'm sure you appreciate, your worship, that any party might be the last. It's therefore very difficult. Well, by this time, the lady magistrate and her assistants were both touching their eyes with their handkerchiefs, and if it had been possible for them to award a medal for what the Zealander had done, I'm sure they would have done. But anyhow, he was acquitted without any... And he was asked if he could take time, as soon as it was convenient, to conform to the requirements of the law with regard to his vehicle. Well, a typical operational day then, or a typical day, would be something like that. And a typical operational day, of course, the climax would be you'd take off to carry out the operation. Now, some days, obviously, there were stand-downs. It was rare that, particularly in 1941, that bomber crews were expected to fly two nights in succession. Very rare. That happened much more frequently later on in the war, but not in that time. So you'd normally expect a stand-down and would get a stand-down fairly early on the day after an operation, which allowed their crew, you know, to pursue their own interests. There were squash courts at RAF Station Scampton, a pre-war permanent Air Force station.
So it had a lot more facilities because it was...
Oh, yes, because it was a permanent pre-war base. There were facilities for playing soccer or rugby. Seven-a-side rugby was very popular. All air crew were honorary members, as far as I know, of all golf clubs in Britain during the war, and many of us would go off and play around of golf. And of course, there were things like girlfriends in the vicinity that could be visited and so on. There never seemed to be any shortage of things to do.
And you were saying about the free hotel rooms for white crews.
Yes.
I think they got away with quite a bit. The New Zealander got off quite easy. The honorary memberships in golf clubs.
And then there was, as you mentioned, this Lord Nuffield. He was the British automobile manufacturer. Made a contractual arrangement with the I'm pretty sure it was a total of 50 of the best hotels in Britain. An operational air crew, now they could be from fighter squadrons or bomber squadrons, could arrange for vacations at any one of these hotels, and there would be absolutely no question of any billing or any exchange of money at all, no matter how much you use the bars, the lounges, the restaurants, or indeed how many guests you had. There was no question of paying. It was one of the more generous gestures by public-spirited elder Britons towards their towards the air crew, operational air crew of the Air Force.
Now, do you have anything else to say about the life at Scampton, or should we move on?
No, except that inevitably, from time to time, maybe about once every 2 months, there'd be a mess party at which you could invite guests. And in fact, it was one of these mess parties where my friend invited his girlfriend and she became my wife. But we won't go into that.
Okay. What was your rank at this time?
Throughout most of that first tour, pilot officer, except that there was an automatic promotion to flying officer.
Would that be after so many missions?
After 6 months. After 6 months service as an officer, unless you had committed any scheduled misdemeanors, you automatically became a flying officer. So I became a flying officer during that period. I was at Scampton from June of 1941, the end of June, until early May of 1942. So it was, the 6 months would have elapsed during that period, so I would automatically have exchanged my extremely thin ring for a fatter ring and the rank of flying officer.
And your first tour ended in 1942?
Mm-hmm. Yes,
200 hours of flying time?
Yes, at that time a tour was measured by a number of hours, 200 hours operational flying. We did actually, I think it was 31 sorties classified as operational sorties to make up our 200 hours and completed. And we knew, of course, you know, what would be our, quote, last flight in early May, and we completed our flight. And then, coincidentally, and it was unusual, four crews on 49 Squadron completed an operational tour at the same time. This was very unusual, and there was a very special party, officers' mess party for this. I suppose it can safely be told now, even allowing for austerity in Britain, the memory of austerity in Britain during the war. We sent one aircraft off to Compton Mackenzie's farm on the Isle of Arran off the coast of Scotland to get some fresh poultry. Our intelligence officer claimed to be a magnificent angler, so he was flown up to the north of Scotland to fish for salmon. And an Australian who claimed that he was on our squadron, who claimed that he was related, obscurely it seemed, to the owner of a whiskey distillery in Glasgow, he went off there to get in an illegal stock of Scotch whiskey. It was an absolutely magnificent party, probably the best party I've ever attended, particularly as I was one of the fortunate group that was celebrating the end of an operational tour. And then the following morning, we flew off to our respective postings. I was sent back to Upper Heyford to become a bombing leader instructor at the operational training unit where I had done my training less than a year earlier.
You didn't much care for that, did you?
No, it was tedious. It was you simply lost that zest that came from being involved in an operational unit. Tedious in the sense that you were. Even though we were in our young 20s as instructors, it looked as if we were trying to teach children. You changed so much through you matured in a peculiar way so much during an operational tour that air crew that hadn't had the experience seemed to be like children nursing their mother's breast. It's nevertheless, you know, time passed, and I was fortunate. You were normally expected to be on a rest period for 9 to 12 months, but I was able to get myself back on the squadron, the same squadron, 49 Squadron, to start a second tour. Less than 9 months after I'd arrived at Upper Heyford.
And you did fly a couple of missions during your rest period, the first 1,000 bomber raid?
Yes, I suppose it seems strange. It certainly seems strange when I think about it, that the there was I arriving at Upper Heyford to do a period as an instructor in a rest from the operational theater of war. And the planners at Bomber Command Headquarters had different ideas, because they had decided as a gesture, and it was a very important gesture at the time, to mount 1,000 bomber raid on Germany, just to show the Germans. Show the Germans just what they had let themselves in for after their winter of heavy bombing of Britain. In order to mount such a force, Bomber Command had to call on all the serviceable aircraft in the operational training units, as well as all the squadrons, and to man the aircraft in the operational training units, they called upon the experienced aircrew members like myself. So I found in less than a week after beginning my rest period that I was in a Wellington aircraft flying with a man that I'd met only the day before on the first 1,000 bomber raid on Cologne, which was an extremely successful attack. The weather conditions were perfect. The German defenses were quite overwhelmed, and the attack was probably one of the most concentrated attacks, certainly the most concentrated attack up to that stage of the war. Two or three nights later, the force was reassembled to attack, I think it was Essen or Bremen. In our case, we had engine trouble and had to abandon the operation, but it was quite apparent that the second operation was not nearly as successful as the first. The weather conditions were adverse, and the attack was very scattered and not so effective. So it, nevertheless, as a gesture, as a warning, as an indication to the enemy what was to come, it probably served a very useful purpose.
Okay, now, following, it was 9 months, was it, at Upper Hatcher?
Yes, I was there from the, until the beginning of February of 1943. Now, I didn't go, I think it was just before then, because I knew I was going back to 49 Squadron. The world had changed. Hamdens had gone and been replaced by Lancasters, easily the Royal Air Force's most successful bomber of the war. And the aircraft were equipped now with radar navigation aids, which totally changed the concept of navigation. And I went to what is called a conversion unit in order to learn. I spent a week at this conversion unit in order to learn how to use this new airborne radar equipment for navigation purposes.
Didn't have that while you were teaching?
No, it hadn't yet penetrated down to the operational training unit. In fact, at that stage, just at that stage, training crews went from the operational training unit to conversion units, where they would convert to the heavy bombers, the Lancasters, or in two other bomber groups, Halifax aircraft, the large new aircraft, in order to convert, obviously, both pilots to the new aircraft and navigators and gunners and so on to the new equipment. Nevertheless, it was relatively easily learned. After all, we were young and receptive. And I arrived at the 49 Squadron to begin a second tour as the squadron bombing leader now, having been promoted to flight lieutenant to be one of the staff officers on the squadron.
And in this position, you got to choose the missions you would go on.
Yes, you didn't, to use the colloquialism, you didn't crew up as a staff officer. You weren't expected to fly every operation. Otherwise, your tenure as a staff officer was likely to be too brief. Mm-hmm. What you tended to do, because after all, as a staff officer, you were supposed to be setting an example, you tended to try to make sure you got on crews for the more glamorous and the more exciting and obviously the more dangerous operations. I did actually, for the last 10 trips of my second tour,